That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Hello, how you doing? I'm Craig Parkinson. You are listening to the Two Shot Podcast. Sit yourself down, pop the kettle on. We're going to have a nice old chat. Who's it with this week? I'm going to tell you right now. How the devil are you? Yes, I know it's not Thursday, but I've had a really tough week. It's been really difficult, and I'm not joking. It's been busy. It's been my little boy's birthday, and it's been half term. And then this week, one of the kittens decided to leg it out of the back door of the house, under the fence, and off into the city centre of Manchester. And I spent from 9:15 in the morning till about 9:30, 9:45, I don't know, maybe later, trying to find this kitten and reassure a 10-year-old boy who was much more positive than I was. I was going, we're going to find him. Internally, I'm going, there is no way a few months old kitten is going to survive roaming around the streets of Manchester with cars and people and other cats. So I was just losing my tiny mind, and he was very positive, going, he'll definitely come back, he'll definitely come back. So I'm walking around every half an hour, every street, shaking cat food, shouting his name. I'm knocking on every neighbour. Have you seen this cat? In the end, if anybody follows me on social media, you know I had to put it up on social media. And then, unbeknownst to me, the Manchester Evening News put something on their website about it. So anyway, I'm down on my knees, still shaking cat food at like 9:30, 9:45 at night. I'd had neighbours out looking, still no sign. And it was literally on my knees, looking under cars yet again. One more shake of cat food, and unbelievably, this tiny black but now very dusty little kitten just comes running at me. And I just screamed to one of my neighbours who was around the corner going, I found him! So much so that my little boy heard from the house. And I brought him in, gave him some food. He was totally fine. And I think we all had a small cry of joy that he was back. But yeah, it was a very, very stressful day, and I didn't need any more stress in my life. But this little kitten decided to add to it. I'm not saying that that is an excuse why we didn't deliver you an episode yesterday, but just to keep you up to date with what's going on, because I don't ramble enough on this podcast. But I'm very happy, because I was supposed to meet up with actor and stand-up comedian Rachel Jackson, who is a huge ball of energy, and I've been a big fan of her since I saw her in 2019's film Beats, which we talk about very briefly. You must catch it. It'll definitely be on Netflix or Amazon. And it's as a really fantastically funny and wild film. I think you'd really enjoy it, so do go and check that out. Anyway, we were supposed to meet up in person. In the end, we couldn't, so we've had to go back to the remote just for a few more weeks, hopefully, and then we can meet up with people in person. But yeah, this week is a brilliant conversation with Rachel Jackson. She's very funny, she's very candid. There is not as much swearing as what you would have thought. But it's great. It's a great episode. I'm glad she sat down with us. I'm glad she sat down with us. I don't have to talk that slow, do I? So yeah, I really, really hope you enjoy this. She's great. This is the Two Shot Podcast with the brilliant Rachel Jackson. There's a police car, probably, after some kittens. I'll see you at the end.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Rachel, how are you?
I'm good, how are you?
I'm good. How's it felt to start back gigging slowly?
I mean, honestly, it's music to my ears just to be back out on the gigging scene, you know. It's been a pretty crappy year, hasn't it?
But as ever, I always thought that theatres and comedy clubs would be the last to open. Because especially as we know, most comedy clubs, they're not like big arenas. They're small, sort of sweaty cellars.
Yeah. And it's the worst, you know, with everyone laughing next to each other. It's like kids. It's like super spreaders at comedy clubs.
Yeah, they're like primary schools. They're like little Petri dishes of bacteria.
Yes, exactly.
The last place
and happiness.
I kind of want to be going. And laughter, which is what we need.
I know. So, no, I am so glad. But I keep getting gigs cancelled, left, right and centre as well, because of COVID rules changing every 5 minutes. So...
But you'll have already sort of booked travel and things, wouldn't you?
Yeah, because I'm actually learning how to drive at the moment.
Right, how's that going?
It's going pretty good. Everything about my personality would suggest that I'd be a rubbish driver. But it's the opposite. I'm actually pretty good. Yeah.
Are you trying to say you're someone that lacks focus, Rachel?
Well, actually, no. It's more like hyper-focus when I'm doing one thing. But with driving, as you know, you've got to do like 18 things at once.
Yeah, but safety... Safety, safety. That's paramount.
That's number one.
Put that to the top of the list.
Okay, then that's the... Safety is like my last priority in life.
Okay, so, make it your first. Otherwise, we need to stay off the roads.
Stay off the roads forever.
That's everybody.
No, honestly, I really enjoy it. But after every lesson, I don't know if this is normal or not, but after... probably not. You're going to tell me it's not. Every time I come in from a driving lesson, it feels like my brain's been in a microwave for an hour.
Well, the thing is, what number lesson are you on at the moment?
Five.
Right, you're right. Okay, look. Hey, we all start somewhere. I mean, in about 6 years, I'm going to have to start doing it with my little boy, who's already asking. He's only just turned 10 when he can drive. I went, not yet. We'll be going around deserted sort of car parks late at night in supermarkets where you can't hit anything or anybody.
Exactly.
But it's quite intense because you're in that car... For at least an hour.
Yeah.
Sometimes you're doing double lessons. There's a lot of information you've got to process whilst you're focusing on the road, whilst you're focusing on other drivers, and you've got a driving instructor.
Yeah.
And this isn't a diss to any driving instructors listening. I've had a few in my time. They're quite dull with their personality. They're driving instructors. They're teaching people in a car how to drive. And I take it you're masked up at the moment.
Masked up as well. And, you know, in my, like, I'd started, well, when I was 17, I started driving lessons. And then I ran out of money and patience around the same time. So I stopped. And then I lived in London for 7 years, where, you know, as you know, in London, you don't need to drive. And then I went out with a guy for 4 years who drove. So again, didn't need to drive. And then that, it came to an end just before the pandemic. And I thought, right, this is it. Finally, I need to learn how to drive. As a 33-year-old woman, I'm getting it done. And so my mum took me out for quite a long time last year. Like, I would drive her to work and everything. So I was getting pretty good. But then I was like, right, now I need to get professional lessons. And then, you know, when suddenly you've got, like you're saying, I'm suddenly in this car with this guy and all my bad habits that I picked up with my mom. And because people, you shouldn't go on lessons with people who've been driving for 20 years or 30 years. They don't know how to teach. And why should they be able to? That's not their, you know.
But all that, yeah, they're not teachers. You know, it's a bit like, well, it is like there's parallels of quote-unquote homeschooling, which thankfully you didn't need to do, but... I'm not a teacher.
Yeah,
you know, there's people who actually do homeschooling. This is somebody coined the phrase emergency education, which I thought was much
emergency education.
Yeah, I mean, that's a much more perfect way to describe it than that. But also, yeah, you're quite right. These people have been driving for 10, 15, 20 years.
I know.
They're not teachers. They're just passing down their habits.
Yeah, exactly.
Actually, yeah, see what I did there? Don't do that.
Yeah, that's what my mum says. Don't listen to anything I'm saying. And I'm like, well, why are you letting me drive?
Why are we in the car?
Why are we in the car? So this guy, he's really nice, to be fair. But yeah, it's like my brain. I've got a theory, Craig. He's like my third cousin. You know, those weird relations, you don't actually know what they are, but they're like family. Yeah. He sat his test 13 times and failed 13 times, and he can't drive. He went to Oxford University. He's like the smartest person I've ever met, and he can't drive. I've got a theory: the smarter you are, the harder it is to drive.
I think so, because I remember, you know, when I was 17 and I was in the Northwest, and there was all these absolute idiots who just passed their test and they were out in their Escort XR3Is and just bombing it around. How are you on the road?
Totally. All the way Ned's from my high school, like past at like 16.
Just for those that I know, just for those that don't know, could you explain what a Ned is?
Oh, right, yeah. So Ned is like the Scottish word for chav.
Which is a non-educated
delinquent.
And if anybody hasn't seen the film Ned, then you should definitely go and see that.
Check it out.
And, from driving lessons to horse riding lessons, and I'll tell you for why, Richard Jackson. The other year, seems a long time ago now, it was in 2019, I was in the arse end of nowhere in Yorkshire because I'd been sent off to do some horse riding lessons the next day. So I had to get there in the evening, and it was for work. It's not like it was not something that I fancied doing, but I hadn't done it for a long time. I did say that, oh, I'm totally fine on a horse. I'll just need a few refresher lessons and I'll be fine. The size of this thing, I don't know, it was huge. But I found myself kicking about this very small Yorkshire town and I didn't know what to do. Mm. And there was a beautiful cinema there. And I thought, well, I'll go and see what's on. And there was a film that I wanted to see called Beats was on. So I went to go and see that before my horse riding lesson.
No
and that's
way.
Where, yeah, and that's where I first saw you, which was such, I don't talk about work that much because on the podcast, as you know, but it's kind of different for certain people because it's like, well, not that I want to put you in a bracket, but you know, you're a stand up. And now you're doing lots of acting, and this wasn't just out and out comedy acting at all. The film wasn't a comedy. There was such darkness to it. But how did you get involved with that? Because I still think it didn't get enough praise.
I know.
About what
I know. It's a shame.
And it should have done, because it was such a classy film.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
And a largely untapped and undiscovered cast.
Yeah. Honestly, it's funny because see, when we were filming it, right, we were all buzzing and we were all gassed. We were like, this is it, guys. This is it. This is our big breaks. Like, we were all, you know, when you're like in the van on the way to set and all that, and we were like, this is it. And then we're filming the rave and we're like, we knew it was special. We knew it was a special film. And then halfway in, about 3 weeks into filming, Steven Soderbergh came on board to be the executive producer.
Of course he did. Yeah.
So you can imagine us all on that bus on our way to work that day, like, oh my God, Steven Soderbergh's attached. Like, this is it, guys. One of my pals on it, was I won't name names. She was like that. I swear we won't be able to buy milk after this. We were all gassed. She was like, we won't be able to buy milk. This is like, this is it. We'll get stopped on the way to the shops. And we were all gassing ourselves up beyond belief because we knew it was a special film, you know? And then it was like getting reported by Deadline Hollywood, the new Trainspotting's currently filming, you know? So, of course, we were really excited and, you know, and don't get me wrong, it is a brilliant film, but I think it's just a number of things. I don't think enough people saw it. Maybe the PR campaign didn't have as much money as it should have. Or
yeah, I mean, it's always the thing, especially with independent cinema, that people have just, you know, it's blood, sweat and tears. And, you know, even before the cast have got on, there's probably years and years of development and producer hell that people have to go through to actually go, right, here's a call sheet, we're on, first day, we're filming, we haven't got enough money of what we wanted, but we're here, and we're going to make the best of it. And you really did, I thought everybody was, can you just tell people that haven't seen it, because I do want people to see it.
Oh, bless you.
Because it's much, if you described it, or you read a blurb, or even I think if you saw the trailer, you'd go, I'm not really sure that that's for me.
Yeah.
But it's so rich in detail.
Mm. Yeah, so it's a black and white film. It's set in 1994 in Scotland.
All right, stop you right there. Black and white, no. Next minute you'd be saying subtitles. It's like, no. It's so funny when you say that about it being black and white.
Yeah.
It's so colourful.
I know, and I know that
Do you know what I mean when
off.
I say that?
I know, because we didn't know it was going to be black and white when we were filming it, so we just assumed, you know, why would you assume it was going to be black and white, right? And then when I bumped into a guy at this industry thing who said, oh, have you seen Beach yet? Because he'd worked on it as well. I said, no. And he went, you know, it's black and white. And my face dropped, because I've got a thing where I say to people, I don't like black and white films. I don't watch films before The Godfather. Like, I'm like,
oh, Rachel Jackson, come on now.
I know, it's ridiculous. But it's again, like what you were saying about focus. Like, it's something about, I don't know what it is about my personality, but unless it's like, you know, bright and colourful and got Robert De Niro in it, I'm probably not interested. No. But you know what I mean? I just don't really have patience for black and white film. But in all fairness, I've tried to go back on that now because I think it makes me sound like an idiot when I'm such a film lover. So I watched Whatever Happened to Baby Jane last year. And I was just like, wow. Like, why have I not been watching more Bette Davis, you know, performances? Cause that's,
oh my God, yeah.
Yeah, that's like my dream role, like her performance in that. And I'm like, the only thing that put me off for all these years watching a film like this was because it's in black and white. And then I saw it and I was like, this is unreal. I wasn't bored. It's like, it's quite a long film as well. And,
oh, yeah, yeah.
But it's just something, but you can understand what I'm saying. A lot of people don't want to sit and watch a black and white film, especially when you can use colour. It's not like, you know, this is 100 years ago.
But also there's certain people from, you know, a different generation who will not touch a film that's got subtitles.
Sometimes
maybe I might say to my dad, oh, right, so look, I've seen this incredible Italian film.
Yeah.
It's right up your street.
Yeah.
The subtitles. No.
Yeah, no, not interested.
I'm okay, not interested.
Yeah, because they think it's an extra level of concentration. And I do get that.
Well, I get that, but for some reason, I don't know why, my little boy, obviously apart from when we're going to the pictures, which we haven't done of late, but for watching films at home, he likes to put the subtitles on.
Yeah, my friend does that. When she's watching,
I think I'm into it. I kind of...
Oh,
I'm
really? Like,
yeah, I don't... Well, I think it's because right now I don't really have a choice, because if we're watching something...
That's why.
We've kind of come to the conclusion that, well, yeah, you're going to put the subtitles on and I'm going to let you do it. Well, right, I'm going to go off to the kitchen to go and make popcorn.
Yeah.
And it's just something that he gets more out of a film with the subtitles on.
That's interesting. I wonder why that is.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I must look into it a bit more.
Yeah, because my friend, we're both on a Grey's Anatomy binge at the moment, so we send each other screenshots of which bit we're at, and I saw that she had the subtitles on. I went, oh, why have you got the subtitles on? She went, oh, don't slag me off. It's just, I just enjoy it more with the subtitles on. And I was like, what? Because I would just read it. If the subtitles were there, I wouldn't be looking at the people acting. I'd be looking down at the words.
But you get into it. There's something...
Really?
Yeah, you get into it because you're looking, you're reading and you're watching at the same time. So maybe it's adding another layer of richness that we've been missing for all these years. But I don't know. Sometimes, obviously, you're forced into it, which can be a good thing.
Mm.
But we went to see the original Godzilla.
Oh, right.
At the cinema.
What,
not long
Matthew
ago.
Broderick? Like the pure
no,
original?
No, the original from 1954.
Oh, right. See what I mean?
Rachel, yeah,
this
I know.
This is what I'm talking about.
There's an. I'm 45, he's 10, and he knows more about a 1954 Japanese film than I do. But obviously, the subtitles are on for that.
Yeah.
So maybe you got into it that way.
Yeah.
Because he's well, such fair a enough, fanatic. You know? Look, whatever works, and, you know, we never stop learning. I can learn from him, and if that's...
Whatever
if that's,
works, baby.
if that's the way that I'm going to consume
It sounds like
movies.
You've got Stockholm Syndrome, though, Craig. You're like, yeah, I kind of don't mind the subtitles now.
Yeah, it's called being a dad. Kind of got no choice, Rachel, to be honest.
That's it. That's it.
So have you always been quite... Because you're quite an up character.
Yes,
And as a human being, the little I know.
Yeah.
But you are quite like that on social media as well. And sometimes I do read things that you put out and I go, I don't know where the Rachel, the actor or the stand-up sort of ends and Rachel, the human being.
Yeah, I know.
Sometimes it can be a bit blurred.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of part of what I'm trying to do. If I'm being perfectly honest, like, I think I have got a big personality, and I've always had one since I was little. Like, my dad only told me recently that, like, when I was a kid, people thought I had ADHD. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but people would say it to my dad, and my dad would be like, no, she's just spirited. You know? And, yeah, I don't know, I've always had loads of energy, and I've always been... Like, with my comedy and stuff, I like very deadpan, very dry, I've got a very dark sense of humour. Like, my favourite genre of films is horror films. I could watch 10 horror films a day if I had the time. So I'd say my personality and my humour is quite extreme. And I do like... I think my favourite actor in the whole world is Christian Bale. I'm completely obsessed with him. And so I think that's quite a good example of, you know, the intensity that I like to put out there as well. And I do like to confuse people a bit. I do want people to be a bit like, is she having a mental breakdown or is she a genius? You know? And that's kind of what I'm going for.
And are you good at, have you always been good at channeling your energy into your work? Because on what I'm thinking about, sometimes if you're spirited, one would say, taking Mr. Jackson's word here.
Exactly.
Sometimes at school, they don't like a spirited child.
Oh, no.
They like
God,
to
no.
keep things in order and people in the boxes.
Yeah.
So how was that for you at school?
I would get told, why can't you be more like your brother?
Oh, right. Really?
Because my brother's super intelligent. Like, he went to St. Andrews Uni and he's, you know, a really intelligent guy. And in fact, I've got some news about him that I can't reveal yet. So hopefully if the listeners listen to this, by the time this goes out and stuff, I'll be able to reveal my brother's exciting news, but that's doomed for now. But, so I got told, why can't you be more like him? Because he was, like, really studious, really intelligent, very quiet, and I was just the complete opposite, like an absolute maniac. But, you know, some teachers liked me, some didn't. It's just, you know what it's like at school.
Look, that's just the way it is. You can't please everybody, and nor should you. I tell my little boy, look, don't get frustrated, but you can't be good at every subject. So
no,
just,
of course not.
You know, you carry on focusing on...
Apart from the we are souls that are.
Yeah, we're told that we have to be, but we know that's not true.
Yeah, exactly. Because I was, this isn't just about me at high school, I was top set English, bottom set maths. And I think that a lot of kids have that where they're like really good at something but just appalling at something else. And it's a shame because then you're in maths class and you're getting kind of treated like you're just a bit dumb. And I'm like, no, that's just not the way my brain works. But put me in an English class and I'll get A's.
Exactly, yeah.
So it's just, you know, but it's like hindsight's a funny thing, eh? I wish we could all go back and tell ourselves, like, don't worry, don't get yourself stressed out. Because maths, I used to dread it. And now I quite enjoy doing maths, like when I'm doing my wee invoices and stuff.
Well, it's like when I've been going back and teaching and relearning long division. Not, not Not for fun, right? So
not for fun.
Obviously.
Never for
but
fun.
But it's like, oh, right, I kind of get it now. So it's a bit like when I had to try and learn music theory. It's just a different language and it's a different code. Or it's a bit like when you're baking a cake, there's lots of different elements to it. But it's not like when you're cooking a dish, you can be creative and experiment when you're cooking. But when you're baking a cake, my God, you've got to be scientific and carry on and look at that recipe. Because if anything goes over or anything goes under, anything doesn't go in, you ain't got a good cake.
That's
so it's just to say, once you know the code and the rhythm and the language of it.
Yeah. You're good to go.
Everything else falls into place, I'm sure. But when did stand-up comedy come into your life?
Oh, stand-up comedy only came into my life, you know, quite recently, like 2015. Which,
really?
Yeah, which is very, like, a lot of people would still consider me a very, very, very new comic.
Mm.
But I'd always liked having a laugh, and I'd always liked, like what you were saying about my Twitter, that I remember at drama school... Because I was like one of the only working class people at my drama school, and it was very posh. And
where was that, Rachel?
I was at Rose Bruford.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, and I loved it, but there was times when I absolutely hated it. I think that's quite normal for a drama school experience. But there was one guy in my year, like looking back, he was a total prick, and he was just very judgmental. And I at the time I thought it was just to me, but since I've spoken to other people about him, they were like, "Oh no, he was like that with me as well." And then other ones, "Oh yeah, no, he was like that with me." Because he was just so judgy and so condescending, very patronising. And one time he, because I'd done a tweet, because I'd actually been on a date and the guy had accidentally broken my hand and I'd ended up in A&E. And I'd
what, on the date?
On the date, yeah. And but I didn't know it was broken at the time. It was just like really sore because like my pinky was like pretty much hanging off. It was like down there, but we still went back to his and everything. And then... he just gave me like peas from the freezer and I just, you know, ow, 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 and just went to bed. So it didn't end up that well. But then the next morning I woke up and I was like pain I'd never felt. So I went up to A&E and they misdiagnosed it. They thought it was just a broken pinky. Mm. So that's all that they did, an x-ray, just bandaged up and then sent me off on my way. 3 weeks later, I was still walking around like that guy in Scary Movie. Like my hand was like that for weeks. I lost so much weight. I couldn't eat because, you know, when you think about it, you can't cook with one hand.
No.
So rather than trying, I just stopped eating. Again, this is my personality. I'm like, it's quite extreme. Rather than getting someone to come and live with me for a couple of weeks and help me out, I'm like, well, I'll just stop eating and I'll just eat a chocolate bar or whatever. So I was going into drama school getting skinnier and skinnier. My hair getting like, it was like Amy Winehouse. My hair was like up in like a big bee's nest.
Matted beehive.
Yeah, matted beehive. And people are like, are you okay? And this is when I genuinely wasn't okay. It wasn't like now when it's like a bit of an art what I'm doing. I was just a mess. And then eventually I went back to the hospital after 3 weeks and then they did another x-ray and they were like, no, your hand is broken. We need to put you in a cast, like immediately. Like, we're so sorry that someone... So I'd been walking around for weeks with a broken hand and I didn't even know. But anyway, long story short, I'd done this tweet, like a comedy tweet, like when your date goes so well, you end up in A&E, like hashtag winning or something. And this... Just a bit of a laugh. And this boy in my drama school was like, Rachel, you know, because we were in our third year of drama school at this point, and he was like, you know, you're really going to have to calm down this persona of yours because people aren't going to want to work with you because you just seem like a complete mess. And, you know, and I just remember thinking, you don't know anything about me or about what I'm trying to do. Even though at the time I wasn't trying to do it, I was just a mess. But like, you might have been onto something. But my point is that I always knew I had, what I'm trying to say is like, I've always had utter faith in myself, in my abilities, in what I do, like with my acting. And like I wasn't a stand-up then, I was just purely focusing on the acting. But I always thought I was like really, really good. I always had such utter faith in myself, despite any obstacle. Mm. And this guy, that's just one example of the way he was with me, and it has haunted me a bit. I'm a very sensitive person. I'd say I'm like very emotionally intelligent. When someone says something like that, like, it stays with me forever.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've got, but I think all performers have a bit of that, you know.
Well, I think they do. You know, at the end of the day, they can stand up and say, "Look, what you say, I don't care. It doesn't hurt me." And then they can walk away from that situation and probably just have a little bit of a cry or a worry.
Yeah.
Or a small breakdown in the corner.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
Yeah.
I'm always intrigued about people who do read reviews.
Oh, yeah. There's one review that I still haven't read from the Edinburgh Fringe 2017. I refused to read it because my ex-boyfriend at the time read it for me and he said, don't read it. So I still haven't read it.
But it still haunts you.
Well, not really, because at the end of the day, it was my first hour at the Edinburgh Fringe and I got a bunch of 5 stars and 4 stars and 3 stars. So it's like, I did really well and I got loads of great reviews, but also you get 2-star reviews. The only one I didn't get was a 1-star. I was gutted. I was like, can someone just give me a 1-star? And then I've got the whole lot.
I've ticked all the boxes for my first Edinburgh.
Yeah, exactly. I got 3 2-stars. And one of them one of them was quite a nice 2-star review, if that makes sense. It read more like a 3-star. But one of them apparently was just nasty. And I thought, well, what's the point of reading that? I'm not that much of a narcissist that I would want to inflict that on myself. So I just thought, what's the point? Because you know what they say about reviewers. You know?
Exactly. And also, if you're doing, and I'm taking you were doing the full August of Edinburgh.
Yeah, the full thing, yeah.
I mean, if you're going to start reading reviews at the top of a run,
I know.
It's a long road to down from August, if you've got that.
Dead man walking.
Yeah, exactly. No way. That's not conducive for
Edinburgh. No, I know. But if you've ever, met comedians who, whilst in Edinburgh, whilst they're doing the Fringe during August, they're all mental. Because it's just, you're not sleeping right, you're not eating, probably drinking too much. It's just a mental month. Good reviews, bad reviews. For your mental health, it really isn't a good thing.
Yeah, and the majority of comedians aren't just doing their show. They're popping on and doing other people's, or they're going to do what is that very famous? It starts at midnight.
Oh, late in life.
Late in life.
Yeah, I've done that.
I mean, everybody's always doing that.
Yeah.
And that is, I've been once.
Yeah.
And it was as if the monkeys had taken over the zoo.
You know
it
what,
was just
Craig?
Drunk,
I'm
scared. I mean, it was scary.
Like mental.
Nuts.
That sounds like my kind of gig that I do well at, though. honestly, Craig, I did late in life 2019. The last Fringe there was, I had a kidney infection and I still, because honestly, comedy is an addiction. Stand-up comedy is an addiction. I was ill, I was on my antibiotics, I was recovering and I still went and did Late in Life and I was hobbling on stage because you're that desperate. You're just that desperate for the gig and for the laughs and for the money as well. But and I remember it was crazy because people had warned me about Late in Life. They were like, it's mental. Even if you enjoy rowdy crowds, it's mental.
Exactly
what you
level.
Said. Yeah, the monkeys at the zoo, just crazy. So I go in there kind of expecting that and ready for it. They were like zombies. It was it was mental. I got so unlucky because I'm a comedian who particularly likes a rowdy crowd. No, I'm not talking so crazy that you can't hear yourself think or talk, but ones that, people are really engaged, really up for it. An odd wee heckle. I don't mind heckles. As long as they're not nasty, I don't mind people getting involved and having a bit of a laugh. As long as they're not pissing everyone else off to the point that they're not enjoying it. I think I've got quite a good balance, to how to, But, when I did Late in Life, Craig, it was it was about 100 people just sat there. I don't know what they were on. But they were to all of us, not just me. Jade Adams was hosting it. And I was on, and there was other acts, and we were all just getting nothing, no reaction. I was like, "Why are you still out then? If you're all wanting to go to your bed?"
Yeah, I mean, it's not exactly Sunday morning 10 o'clock comedy show where you just sit there and let it pour over you. It thrives on that wave of audience interaction all the time, and it's there's always a real sort of buzz of energy in the room.
Totally, late in life, like you said, it's like a notorious gig. And I just got it on a bad night, I guess. And it was 2 a.m, me with my kidney infection, up on the stage just thinking, well, this wasn't worth it.
Well, hopefully when everything gets up and running late and live comes back, then you'll experience it a bit different.
I hope so.
Rachel, for somebody who, as you say, was so focused on training to be an actor, and I know that that still happens and the two sort of work in tandem. But when did stand-up comedy come into your life? Because it's very different for someone saying, I'm dead funny down the pub or I'm dead funny in this situation to get on stage,
yeah,
he's so exposing, yeah, and working your way up and doing your 5 minute slot and, yeah, 10 and, yeah, sort of building everything up until you've got your first sort of, yeah, 45 minutes or an hour.
Yeah. It's, well, all, I can only sort of describe it as an addiction. And like I said, I'd always like, I think, had a good sense of humour and made my friends laugh with all my ridiculous dating stories and just all the mental shit that happens to me. We are allowed to swear on this, right?
It's actively encouraged.
Oh, Craig, I've been saving the C word so long because it's like my... I'm Scottish. We say it like it's nothing.
Exactly. Don't worry. I have enough Scottish friends. I understand.
But I get in trouble, Craig. Wherever I go, they go, oh, you can't say cunt left, right and centre on this gig. And I'm like, well, I don't want to fucking do it then. No. But yeah, I was minding my P's and my Q's just in case.
Please, bring it on. The floodgates have opened. The floodgates are open. Carry on.
You'll regret that. No. Basically, I'd always like, I have lived quite a mental life. Like, I've lived in lots of different places geographically. I've had some crazy relationships and stories, and I always enjoyed retelling them to people. And I love a good story. I love telling them. I love hearing them. I love reading them. So storytelling, I think, is just the most amazing, and that's why I love good films. And as much as I still love acting, and I'm definitely an actor, and acting's my first and foremost passion, I feel like stand-up, like the stand-up comedy world, has given me more and more quickly than acting has ever given me. As you know, with acting, like, it's a hard, hard, hard industry, and I'm not saying stand-up isn't at all, but I feel like if you're good as a stand-up comedian, you will be rewarded for that a hell of a lot quicker than if you're a good actor. Because there's a million good actors out there who aren't working.
Yeah.
But with stand-ups, if you're good, you do get rewarded for that. You will book gigs.
And also, as a stand-up comedian, you have complete control. You write your material.
Oh, Craig,
You're getting on the train, in your case, in the car for other people. Yes. You'll be in the car soon. Driving to the gig just to, you know, not earn loads, to get that five-minute buzz.
Yeah.
And you're educating yourself, so you're learning as you go, totally, driving all around the bloody country.
Yeah. Oh, no, you've definitely summed it up. I feel like my life, I feel like I'm in control of my own destiny now, as wanky as that might sound. Whereas before, when I was just an actor, I felt like I had no control. I found it really quite depressing. You know, as much as I was liking to write things and try and put on my own one-woman plays and all that kind of thing, you kind of feel like your career's in your agent's hands, and it can be really scary, and that's why
you have to wait for the door to open,
yeah,
and then you have to make that choice of whether you want to step through,
yeah,
once you've been welcomed, and then if not, oh well, wait a minute, the door's just going to be slammed in my face.
I know, it's a horrible feeling, and I applaud actors who do just consider themselves solely actors, who like do that their whole entire lives. I think that's incredible to have that kind of, because as much as I know I'll always act and everything, but this, like, the stand-up buzz and what I've achieved in quite a short space of time, it's so inspiring, and it just makes you keep going, right, well what's next. And it's just that buzz, and like you say, I write, if something crazy happens to me, I'm like, oh well, I'll write it into a bit, even if it's something bad. And a lot of people don't have that control in their lives, that if something bad happens to them, they either have to go to therapy, bury it deep down inside of them, or just try and get over it. Whereas stand-up comedians were like, oh, that was shite, but that'll be a good bit.
Yeah, in a way, that's your therapy, to get on stage and tell everybody what happened.
Totally.
And I think now more than ever, and certainly over the last few years, you don't have to do that one thing. You don't have to just be... I know a lot of actors used to be quite angry when stand-up comedians, and they've only ever been stand-up comedians, oh, they're in a new TV show or they're in a film. Wait a minute, why are you coming into this arena? Just, you get back on stage with your microphone,
please.
Get back
on your mic!
But now, people can go, well, they do X, Y, and Z, and they're known for X, but they also do Y and Z very well. And that's accepted now.
Yeah.
And I think that's absolutely fine. It should be.
It should be, but I still think we've got a lot of work to do. I think we're way behind America on that regard. When you see the people in America who are actors, writers, comedians, stand-ups, they do it all, and it's celebrated. And it's, whereas here, I still think we've got a lot of work to do. Like, when you think of the UK circuit, people who are actors and stand-ups and writers, I'd say it's a much smaller pool than it is in America. It's just, I think it's, like you say, I think it can go in your favour, you know, have it like being sort of multi-skilled, but it can also go against you, because over the years people are like, well, what are you then?
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm like, what do you mean, what am I? Google me, bitch.
I mean, it's one way to start a meeting, Rachel Jackson. I haven't had the balls to do it, but maybe it'll work for you.
No, I mean, like, when strangers, you know, people that have got no foot in the industry at all and judge you, well, what have you done and what have you been in? And are you that or what is it? So what's your biggest passion then? And if you had to pick, if you had a gun to your head, what would you pick, stand-up or acting?
You don't have to.
And I just think, what kind of party is this?
Not one you want to be at, certainly.
You know?
But you don't have to choose anymore. That's the thing. And I think the people that are sort of the gatekeepers and maybe they're commissioning editors and producers, they're going, well, I want a certain type of person who can do all of these things, because that's what we need for this certain thing. But also, on the other hand, there's certain people who just shouldn't be doing it. Because... Do you know what I mean, though? It's like, just because this person is a fantastic storyteller in stand-up, sometimes, and we've seen it, it does not translate well into other arenas.
Of course, yeah.
So people just... it needs to be supported more, but I think, personally, I think it needs to be filtered more as well.
Well, I feel like that. I think that with the acting industry as well, it's so oversaturated. It's just crazy.
Oh, yeah.
You know, when you see on Twitter, like, because I did a call out in January, because I've been writing a pilot sitcom set in a female Scottish prison. And I thought, I should put a tweet out just to see what Scottish actresses are out there, just to, you know, for people to have in mind as I'm writing. I didn't, you know, Twitter, you know, sometimes you can do a genius tweet and get 10 likes, and other times some crap you write can blow up or whatever. But I just wrote, hey, if there's any Scottish actresses out there who like comedy, maybe give me send me your CV or whatever, because I'm writing something. Craig, it was mental. It was absolute hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of Scottish actresses. Like hundreds and it sort of both comforted me and terrified me.
Yeah.
Because you're like, wow, like, there's just
so many.
Where
have you been?
Yeah. Yeah, there's just, and that's just Scottish, that's just the Scottish actress pool. That's, you know, there's every pool for, you know, different types and everything. And it's just like, oh my God. Yeah, it was sort of a crazy moment where, you know, there's the top tier of people, obviously, you know about. And then there's like all the ladder and, you know, between all that. And then hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds more. And it's just, it got overwhelming, because I was like, if I was to sit and watch all these, and now I suddenly felt like what a casting director must feel like every day.
Yeah.
You know? And I thought, I had more empathy that day for casting directors than I've ever, ever had.
Well, that's why you understand why they have to work from certain lists.
Yeah.
And you know, talk about filtering, they have to filter a lot.
I know.
Because can you imagine, and I'm friends, some really good friends of mine are casting directors.
Yeah.
And I know that their inbox sometimes just gets overwhelmed with these people throwing it out there. And of course they have to do it, because they've got to start getting their foot on the ladder of the business. And we've all been there. It has to be done.
Yeah.
Especially in the last year, especially for the graduates. I just think, you poor, poor buggers.
I know, what a time. What a time to graduate from drama school. It's meant to be like the most exciting, you know, stage of your career at that point. And just to have it torn away from you a bit. But I think that goes for not just acting graduates, but every industry in the world this last year has suffered. And, you know, it's like, I feel like, honestly, again, I'll sound like a pure mad hippie, but I feel like it is going to make the human race a nicer bunch of people, this pandemic. I hope so, anyway.
I would hope so, to be honest. I mean, yeah. I've certainly noticed... I haven't noticed it. I mean, that's the thing. I don't know, because I haven't really been out that much.
Yeah, I know. It's crazy, isn't it?
But I'm just starting to... But even when I've been walking on the street, or I've occasionally, you know, over the last week or so, been out for a meal or I've been actually in a pub, I'm going to places that I know. So, of course, people are nice anyway, because I know them.
Yeah.
But I would hope in different environments where... It's not something that you're comfortable with, or, oh, look, there's so-and-so and they always serve me that drink or whatever. Yeah. I know, how are you doing? They're always nice. I hope that you would go to somewhere that was, you know, slightly alien to you, and there would be a bit more kindness than what there used to be.
I think there's definitely like a empathy running through the whole world at the moment. Obviously, some people, you know, there's the anti-vaxxers and, you know, people, everyone's got their own opinion, whatever, even though I think it's crazy. I did a video, I don't know if you saw it on Twitter the other day, I did a video of me, it was like anti-vaxxer outside a vaccination centre, because I found this rave song that was like, injected with a poison, it was called. So I just did a wee video of me in my living room, like, dancing to that. You know, it's like, who's the crazy one?
Yeah.
You know?
I know. Jay Rayner, the food critic, put out a tweet the other day saying how he went to go and get his second jab.
Mm.
And he felt really grateful, and he was just sort of thanking the NHS. And he said, but I was in the cab on the way to or from, I forget, getting the jab. And the taxi driver obviously, you know, wanted some conversation, as they do. And he told Jay Rayner why he wasn't going to get any jabs, because he'd been doing some research.
And
He'd been doing some research, and he's come to the conclusion that, yeah, no, the jab isn't good for us.
Yeah, and it's like, it's the arrogance, isn't it? Of, you know, I know, I've done 10 minutes of reading, so I know more than that Oxford grad scientist or whatever. It is wild. But at the end of the day, obviously, everyone's entitled to their own opinion. You don't have to take something you don't want to, you know, but come on, guys, do you want to go back to normality or not? Because this is our quickest way of doing it. I don't know why people can't get that.
I would hope the more positive among us outweigh the negative.
Yeah, I know.
I would hope.
I know.
Certainly, I don't know any of my friends that are anti getting the jab at all, because they know that it's not just for them.
Hey.
It means that they can...
For mankind,
you know,
man.
I know, but they can go and see the closest people that they haven't seen for a year. They can see their parents. Their parents can see their grandchildren.
It's just, it's a no-brainer to me, but, you know, research. You know, if they've done their research, then...
Well, I was in Cardiff a couple of weeks ago. I was in the lift at 7 o'clock, and I was going down to work. And I had my mask on because I'm in a hotel, and it was still, things hadn't opened up.
Mm-hmm.
And the doors pinged open, and there was, I'm going to describe him as a geezer. He was a geezer.
It's a geezer.
I was just about to come in, and I went, oh, sorry, it's only one person in the lift at a time. And he got all huffy with me and went, I've had two fucking jabs. And I went, all right. I said, but you're still not wearing a mask, and I don't really feel comfortable. Mm-hmm. Is that all right?
Mm-hmm.
And... it is when you fucking prick. And then the doors were just starting to close. And he sort of went for me, and then the doors closed just in time.
God.
So I was quite broken. But I was like, I don't need that aggression. And I certainly don't need it at 7 o'clock in the fucking morning.
Who's got that amount of aggression at 7 o'clock in the morning? Like, that's like waking up angry, ready for a fight.
Oh, selfish people.
You know?
Unhappy people. I don't know.
You know? But I love that accent, Craig. That was great.
Thank you. I'll cut that bit out, don't worry.
no, I loved it.
Rachel, speaking of the writing, how is that going? Have you got to a point where you're talking to producers and commissioners? Because that's another level. You know, we were talking before about how Beats was probably flung around from office to office for years and years and years. This road of development, it is precarious and rocky.
Yeah, it's crazy. And it's funny because, like you say, because for all my years being an actor, when you book a job, obviously it's a brilliant day, but you're totally ignorant to that it's been 2-3 years in development, maybe even longer. I saw a thing the other day that Stephen Fry's doing a project that it's been in the works since 1993 or something, and it's finally happening. And you're like, but if it had Stephen Fry attached, that terrifies me. That I'm like, if it's taken that long, and I don't know, you don't know all the ins and outs of it, but I think people... the general public and people in the industry sometimes aren't always aware of how long these things can take. But that's another sort of funny thing is I remember my first script that was like bought by a production company, and I was like, oh, that's it then. Like, you know, it's like, cause you know, they'd seen my show at The Fringe, and I'd written a sitcom that was pretty much based on The Fringe show. about the sort of bunny boiler character who's desperate for a boyfriend and all that. And they bought it. So they gave me some money and they were like, we want to buy your script and then we'll own it for like a year or whatever and we'll try and get it made. And so that, in my head, I'm like that. Well, that's it, guys. Like, not going to be able to buy milk.
Exactly. I was just about to say that then.
Yeah, exactly. That's it, isn't it? Yeah. Because you just think, well, someone's bought my script and it's got me in it and I'm the lead and, you know. And then the year goes by, nothing happens. Obviously, you keep the money, but then you own it again, so they don't own it anymore. The time's passed. But it's just like, wow, and that was like, what, 2017? And it's now 2021, and that script's still nowhere near, you know. But, you know, it happens to everyone. If you speak to any writer, you'd be hard-pushed to find someone who had their first script bought when they were 17 years old, and then that was it. It's like, it's a long, long... So I don't really get down about it because, again, I'm still quite a new writer. You know, I've always like kept a journal since I was 14. Oh, honestly, Craig, see, if I read you some of the entries out of my 14-year-old self, it was wild because I grew up on Buffy the Vampire Slayer and the Virgin Suicides and, like, my mind was just, oh, I thought I was a poet and it was just the cringiest thing. Like, you know...
There's your new character sitcom idea right there, Rachel.
Yeah, like the cringiest thing you've ever... Like, they do, I've been determined to find one of those because apparently they have these stand-up comedy nights where you take your old teenage journals and you just, like, read, like, a page out and everyone's increasing at how cringy
that is. Such a fantastic idea.
I know. Wouldn't you love that? Like, honestly.
I mean, it'd be brilliant.
I mean, I still cringe at stuff, I've kept a journal since I was 14. Not every single day, but most days since I was 14. Like, I'm quite religious about it. And see, if I was to even read you something from 2 weeks ago, I'd be cringing. So what's that to say? You know, cause
I was going to say, I don't need to cringe about something I did when I was 14.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
I'm 45 and I can tell you a few weeks ago it was awful for me, awful.
Yeah, exactly. Like, why would we want to do that to ourselves? But, so what I mean, though, is I only started really writing properly when I was at drama school. And again, that was born out of frustration of, like, the whole acting thing of, like, at drama school you're getting cast in parts that you would never get cast in the real world, unless you're a big star and then you can kind of just do what you want. And it was just feeling frustrated and a bit stuck because at drama school you can't really work professionally. I know some drama schools let you, but mine certainly didn't. So you're just kind of like stuck for 3 years, even though you're working on your craft and all that. But I just, and I was living in Sidcup, Craig. I mean, come on to fuck.
Right.
You know, it's... You know,
yeah,
it's...
I mean, I think I've passed through Sidcup.
Yeah, I mean, I know it's not very original, we just call it Shitcup, it's not, like, the best name ever, but there was a restaurant, I don't know if it's still there was a restaurant in Sidcup called Sophie's Choice.
Right.
And that sums up Sidcup. I just think, what the fuck? Like, who designed that? Was that, you know, some sort of Nazi sympathiser who owns that place? Like, what the hell kind of name is that?
No,
for a restaurant.
No disrespect to any listeners that live or are from Sidcup, but I'm pretty sure Sophie's Choice isn't still open.
I would just like to say, though, if they are listening, it was damn good food.
Was it?
Yeah, it was.
Something says fish restaurant to me.
No, it was like a steak. It was like a steakhouse.
It was a steakhouse.
Yeah. It was very posh.
Was it?
Yeah, it was really, really posh. That's what it was, just mental to me. Like, what kind of name for a restaurant is that? But whatever.
Table for two at Sophie's Choice.
Table
Rachel
for
Jackson.
Two at Sophie's Choice.
Now, for those that don't know, I do know what Groundlings is.
Yeah.
And I was quite fascinated with it, as I am. I'm always fascinated with comedy and stand-up. I've been for years since I was a kid. And I remember hearing about Groundlings for the first time and thinking, oh, I would love to do that. That sounds like hell and joy at the same time. And it looks really, and it's certainly not an easy ride at all. Could you just explain to everybody what it is and what you're doing, which I want to know more of, because the reason why we had to sort of fit our episode in now, because you're going to be busy later on tonight.
Yeah, so, well, Groundlings is like a improv school and company based in Los Angeles, and it's predominantly improv, but they also do sketch comedy, and it's predominantly character-based, because there's like Second City, and there's all these other really cool improv troupes around the world, in Chicago and New York, and, well, I say around the world, in America. You know, like the big sort of famous ones, I mean, but Groundlings is the one that's really predominantly based on characters. And, you know, my favourite people like Lisa Kudrow and Will Ferrell and Melissa McCarthy and all these total badass, like, mental character people went there. And so it'd always kind of been on my mind, but I'd never... You know what? Life can go so fast and things that you like to do. And then, you know, long story short, when I got dumped, I don't mean to go on a pure sad note, but I got dumped at Christmas 2019, so just before the pandemic, so I didn't even know how shittier things were about to get. And I got dumped...
Perspective, Rachel.
And I got dumped. We'd been together for 4 years, and he dumped me on WhatsApp at Christmas time. And, you know, you'd think I'd had an affair, you know, for that kind of... But nothing of the sort. He just wasn't happy anymore, didn't love me, and that's how he chose to do it. And it was the toughest... It was like the only way I can describe it is having the rug from my life just pulled out from under me. Mm-hmm. Because I can look back and think it wasn't the happiest relationship ever, and I think I was probably in denial for a while, trying to make it work, you know. And we're just too different. I think sometimes things just don't work, and that's fine. But you still don't expect it, you know, when you're just... So long story short, this is what makes me think I'm like the ultimate badass. Because even though I was so depressed, I was so low. 3 days after that happened, I booked a flight to Los Angeles and I booked an audition at Groundlings. 3 days after this happened.
Wow.
Because that's the way my brain works, that I feel like when I'm fucked over, I go into like Ultimate Warrior sort of,
yeah,
you know, like Braveheart. You know, I'm like, like, you know, don't fuck with me, because I'm loyal and I'm a very kind person. All my friends and family would tell you that. And I'll give everything 100 million percent. But once someone crosses the line and that's it, they don't want me. And they're like, you know, it's like, well, now I need to live the best revenge life of all time. You know, but no one likes getting dumped. It's awful.
No, but also you needed to do something for you.
I had to do something for me, yeah. And
something scary, but something scary, important.
Something empowering, scary.
Yeah.
All those things. So me and my mum flew to LA. And so, yeah, how Groundlings works is to, in order, like the people I mentioned, like all the big stars who've done it, they were part of the main company, right?
Yeah.
So you have to work your way up to get to that level. And obviously not everyone makes it that far, or maybe, you know, they make it before they even get, you know, like they get a big, amazing career anyway, whatever. But I looked into it and I thought it just felt like my path. It felt like the right thing to do. So I went to LA with my mum. Audition for Groundlings, had the most amazing time. And I was, like, honestly, I'm not kidding around when I say I was severely depressed, because, you know, I just had my heart broken and my mental health took a real dive, and I was just, I was miserable. But it was like, there's still that part of my brain that I'm like, no, but I still need to, like exceed revenge. Like, I still need to prove this cunt wrong, who's basically thinks that I'm not worth being with. So I'm like, you know, I'm gonna do this, and I'm gonna live this amazing life, and make him rue the day he ever decided to leave me, because that's just the nature of my personality, you know. So long story short, went to LA, auditioned for Groundlings, had the most incredible time at the audition. It was just, I described it like, actually, I said to someone else, and I'm not trying to sound pure, but I think I had a comedy orgasm at the audition.
Explain to me a comedy orgasm.
My whole body started vibrating,
right,
with like good, like funny, positive vibes.
Good energy flowing through you.
Yes.
Right.
I was in this room with all these other really funny people, because even the audition standard, like these, you know, people just, because anyone can audition. You don't have to have had any sort of credits, or, you know, how with like Spotlight, you've got to have done a certain amount of things before you're allowed on it. Nothing like that. You could just go, I want to do Groundlings, and just audition, right? So I go, but the standard, maybe I just got lucky that day, but the standard was so high. Like, everyone was there and they were bringing it.
Wow.
And it was just the most exciting. And the teacher was amazing, and she kept, like, barking things at us to do, like, crazy stuff. And my whole body, like, started vibrating. And I just thought, this is the most exciting feeling I've ever had. It was, honestly, Craig, no word of a lie. So it felt like I was like, right, this is my path. So thank fuck I got in. Imagine feeling like that and then not getting in.
But what do you mean I haven't got in? Did you not see? I had a comedy orgasm,
yes, exactly,
right there and then.
Yeah, I know. Wet floor side, please. I've just, you know. Like, so, and I even said that because we had to go around the circle. It was like AA, but like, you know, we had to go around and say like, you know, what had brought us here and all that. And I thought, I don't want to give them the sob story. I don't want to do X Factor. I don't want to say, oh, I've just got dumped. And I don't want to say any of that because I want my talent to get me in, not my sob story. But I just said, you know, I feel like this is my path now. I've come all the way from Scotland for this. So like, come on, bring it on kind of thing. And I was one of two Brits, even though I hate that word. I hate the word Brit. But it was all Americans. There was one English guy and me. So it felt, and he, to be fair, was living in LA at the time. So it felt like I was like, well, I've made the most bloody effort.
Yeah.
Like I've come, so, you know. So anyway, did the audition. It went really, really well. But you just don't know. You know what it's like with auditions. You can do really well and still not get the job. It's just mental. So anyway, the next day, me and my mum were in Disneyland, of all places, because, you know. And I got the email, and honestly, Craig, I read the email and I was skimming down to the bit that said, unfortunately, because you know what it's like, rejection is rife in our industry. And I've had so many knocks and so many rejections that when I get an email, I just skim and I try and find unfortunately, but it said congratulations. And it was just the most, unreal. I burst into tears. My mum burst into tears. We're crying in Disneyland, Craig. People think we're insane. You know, like, who are these mad Scottish women crying at Disneyland? Like, you're in the happiest place on earth, love.
Exactly.
Like, have a word with your face. You know? And then we went on It's a Small World and we were still crying on It's a Small World. We were just so... Because it was an emotional trip, you know, because of what had happened before. And it was like, oh, thank fuck for that, because that was a long way to come for an audition to have got knocked back.
I mean, you both needed a release.
We both needed a release. Well, I had one in the audition, as I told you earlier.
Oh, well, there we go, yeah. Okay, you had a double release.
I had a double release, yeah. Like, what else can my body do, man? Like, it was unreal. But so anyway, that was just the beginning. That was just the beginning of my journey, because that's just getting into this school. Mm. That's not anywhere near the main company level. But I did a tweet. Do you know Ralph Little?
Know Ralph Little.
That'll be why, because he congratulated me. And I thought, Ralph Little's just congratulated me on Twitter. And I think it's because you'd retweeted it or you'd said, well done, Rachel, or something.
I might have done, yeah.
Yeah, and then Ralph Little was like, wow, this is amazing, congrats. I was like, it's Ralph Little. I was like, just blown away. But then, obviously, I planned to go and start at the school last summer. And then March came and COVID came and the school completely shut down. And it was horrible because I just thought, God, it's like another roadblock to this revenge life that I'm trying to lead, you know? Like, it's a roadblock. And so long story short, a few months ago, they started doing it on Zoom. So they, because obviously they want to keep it going.
And yeah, of course.
So they figured out a way because they've never had to do that, you know? It's always been live. So they figured out a way to do it on Zoom. And so I was getting an email saying that I could start if I wanted, but on Zoom. And I held off for about 3 months because I just thought, that sounds shite. I don't want to do improv on Zoom.
No.
Across the pond where you're on a different time zone to everyone and Wi-Fi can cut out and you could be in the middle of a scene and then it's like, you know, like crazy. Yeah. And I just thought, that sounds like hell on earth. But then the new year came and went and got into 2021 and I just thought, God, who knows how much longer this COVID thing's going to go on for. I should just bite the bull by the horns and try it on Zoom and see how I get on. So I started level one in February, 6-week course. And then at the end of that, found out I passed and I've progressed to level two, which I'm now on. And I've only got 2 weeks left. And then I'll find out if I've gotten to level three. So yeah, that's how it works. It's like comedy Scientology. Like, it's like the, you know, you've got to get to each level to find out more and all that. But not that I'm saying it's a cult, a comedy cult. But so I'm on level two at the moment. Hopefully, fingers crossed, I pass this level and I'll get to level three. And then if I pass level three, then that's me done all the performance side of it. And then the only thing I need to do at that point is do like this like sketch writing thing, just to see.
Right.
Because they need to see if you're a good sketch writer as well as a performer and you know, your characters and stuff. So long story short, I'm working my way up to hopefully get invited to the Sunday company. And if I get invited to the Sunday company, then that means I'll have to pack my bags and go to LA and move.
Well, you know, I would be sorry to see you go, but obviously massive congratulations for all that you're doing. I mean, I think it's absolutely fantastic.
Oh,
I don't know.
Thank you.
I don't know a lot of people that are doing that.
Thanks,
something
Craig.
So historic like Groundlings.
Oh, thank you, Craig. It means a lot.
Lovely.
Thank you. I mean, I just feel like I found my path in life. And I know, again, I sound now I really do sound like I'm in a cult. saying that, but I do feel like I found my path, and I feel like I don't care that it took me this long, because I know some people start on these things when they're 21, or I'm like, you know what, it doesn't matter. As long as you find where you're meant to be in life, it doesn't matter what age you do it at.
It doesn't, and it can come at any time.
Yeah, but it's just, you know what it's like, there's such a, in our industry as well, like ageism and all that kind of stuff, and like I'm 33 at the moment, we get older every day, but I feel like I've got a zest for life, or as Iggy Pop, a lust for life. That it's just stronger than ever. And I'm just like, you know what? Because I know people, even people think, I read an article, Craig, when I was in a really dark mood a couple of years ago. It was one of those awful midnight moods where you just feel like you've made every wrong decision and your career's going nowhere. It's just like a horrible, horrible downward spiral. And I got onto this rabbit hole, horrible online article that said, if you've not made it by the time you're 30, give up. And find something else.
Oh, no, don't read that.
No, I know. And it was the most... And as I was reading, I was thinking, why am I reading this? But you know those awful self-destructive moods where it's just like, you can't stop yourself. Probably like Absolutely. Why people read bad reviews. And, you know, that kind of... When you get into that bad mode. And I was like, why am I reading this? And it was like... It was just basically saying the statistics of people who actually make it in their chosen field, especially in our industry, because it's, you know, there's so many factors. It's not just like if you're a good lawyer you can get to the top, or if you're a good doctor you can get to the top. It's so many other things come into play with what we do. But it was this horrible article, don't know why I read it, but yeah, it was like, especially as a woman, if you've not made it in the entertainment business by the time you're 30, then give up, because you're just going to be old soon anyway, and you're discarded. And I just thought, that's disgusting. But let's be honest, like, it's not completely untrue. I'm not saying 30's old or anything. I'm just saying in our business, like, the way women are treated as they get older is horrific. And I think that's another reason why I love comedy so much, because there's not as much ageism in comedy as there is as a pure actress.
No.
You know, and I'm like, well, I could be really old and wrinkly one day, but I can still be funny, and funny's funny. And it's disgusting. It's something that really angers me. But that's why I've started using retinol as well, because I'm like one of these cunts that refuses to age. I'm just like, I'm 33. I'm like, nah, man. I want to be one of these freaks that when they're 50, people think they're like 35. Like, I've made a deal with the devil. I've got a painting in my attic. I'm on a good streak.
Long may the positivity and the retinal use continue. Rachel Jackson, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thanks, Craig.
And another episode is done. I really hope that cheered up your Friday. She's great, isn't she? There's the... police again. I told you she's a huge ball of energy, and she's great, and she's channeling it in all the right places. And if you didn't know about the history of Groundlings, then give it a Google. The people that have passed through their doors over the years are basically a roll call of some of your favourite comedy actors working out there today. They're brilliant. And it just goes to show, it's like what me and Rachel were talking about. Even though Rachel's saying that, you know, she feels that 33, maybe things have passed her by. Not we all know 33 is very young. But it wouldn't matter if she's 43. Do you know what I mean? Because it just happens at a certain point in your life. And it's like, as Rachel said, I don't know what's going on with my speech impediment today. As Rachel said, she can still be old and wrinkly, and she can still be funny. So it just happens when it happens. And she's channeling it in all the right way. And yeah, do check out Beats. Do follow Rachel Jackson on Twitter. She's very funny. And as she said, gigs are starting to happen. So if you're at a comedy club, you see the name Rachel Jackson, go see her. Tell her I sent you. Okay, look, you know where we are. We are on all the social medias, the Twitter, the Facebook, the Instagram, at @twoshotpod. We're twoshotpod@gmail.com. Do drop us a line. Say hello. Tell us what you're thinking about the episodes. We always love to hear from you. Thanks for all the messages about the episodes over the past few weeks. The Q&A from a few weeks back, which I'm always quite nervous about, to be honest, because for years I'd put them off. People had asked, and I said, oh, I don't really want to do that, because I've, you know, the sort of ethos about this podcast is I never want it to be about me, but I suppose I'm trying hard not to. I would never, you know, I would never want anything to be narcissistic in any way at all. It is always about the guest. But I suppose in that Q&A, it was about responding to the listener. Yeah, that makes sense, doesn't it? Anyway, I'm glad you enjoyed it. I'm glad it went down well. I'm going to go and make some dinner. So I guess I'll see you next week. Okay, well, look, you take care, stay safe, and we'll see you back here hopefully on Thursday next week. Until then, I've been Craig Parkinson, he's been producer Griff, and this has been the Two Shot Podcast. You take care. The Two Shot Podcast is presented by me, Craig Parkinson, recorded and produced by Thomas Griffin for Splicing Block. Our music, our brilliant music, is courtesy of Then Thickens. Cheers.